I'm Mark Labberton, president of Fuller Theological Seminary. Welcome to Conversing. I've been looking forward very much to today and the opportunity to have a conversation with one of Fuller's newer faculty members named Dr. Vince Bantu. Dr. Bantu is on our faculty primarily serving and working out of Fuller's Houston campus as assistant professor of church history and Black church studies since 2019. He also serves in Houston as a liaison to the William E. Pinnell Center for African American Church Studies and networks with various African American churches, pastors, and students in that region and beyond. I just want to say that it has been such a joy to have Vince on our faculty, and I think the impact of even the cult following that is beginning to develop around him is something I think those of you who are listening to this will understand as the conversation goes on. I just want to say, welcome, Dr. Bantu, Vince, how grateful I am that you're my brother in Christ and how thankful I am that you're on Fuller's faculty.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Mark. It's great to be here.
There's all kinds of topics that I'm eager for us to jump into, but one of the things that immediately comes to mind is that we're really right on the verge of Juneteenth. And because it has received in a whole variety of ways a national prominence that it hasn't always been given, I'd love for you to just, first of all, give people a bit of the history of Juneteenth, what you think about its founding and what it means, and then we can talk a bit about that because it's received so much attention.
Yeah, I appreciate that question. And yeah, it feels kind of like a strong connection because I joined Fuller and I moved to Houston and I was new in 2019. I was new to both to Fuller and Houston. And it's been kind of cool that I've been learning about both as I go because I'm originally from St. Louis. And I actually just heard today that St. Louis, Missouri, my hometown, has just finally declared Juneteenth a holiday that they're going to give workers off and all that. We're just now getting to that.
That's a big thing. Yeah.
It was huge. And I mean, because now I'm in Houston and I'm learning about Houston. I didn't even know I had known about Juneteenth and all that. Because I mean, one way to put it is it's the Black community's 4th of July. Because I mean, going back to Frederick Douglass's day, you know, we celebrate the 4th of July and we think about that as being the beginning of American independence. But Black folks were still enslaved, you know, on July 5th, 1776. And so even Frederick Douglass in his life, you know, wrote a famous speech that was basically saying the 4th of July to Black folks, it feels hypocritical to be celebrating independence, you know, and liberation, but we're still a slave. And he wrote that address, you know, at a time when Black folks still were slaves. And so
right.
Juneteenth really represents the 4th of July for Black folks when slavery, the last vestiges of it were fully and completely stamped out. And I didn't know that that actually has a route to Houston. That actually happened in Galveston, a beautiful Gulf Shore town, just about 45 minutes southwest of Houston in 1865, June 19th. So that's where the name comes from. A Union general came down and basically said, look, slavery is over. And obviously the Emancipation Proclamation had ended slavery, but also instigated the Civil War. And then I think it was in April when the last Confederate troops were defeated and the war was kind of over, but there was still slavery going on. And especially in Texas, my new home, which was the westernmost area that had practiced slavery in large numbers, and Galveston was a major slave port and also general part of East Texas. So even though the war had been over for, I guess, 2 months at that point, there was still a lot of slavery going on in Galveston. So Gordon Granger came down and he stood on a beautiful Victorian building, which was built by slaves. And he said, slavery is over, that slaves are free. And that was on June 19th, 1865. And I think it was like the first recorded celebration of that was, I think, the next year. And it was called Emancipation Day. In fact, here in Houston, even to this day, one of the biggest community centers in the city of Houston in the Black community, the Third Ward, is called Emancipation Park. And it's a massive community center. And that was the first recorded celebration of Juneteenth, which was here in Houston.
Wow.
In the Third Ward.
I didn't realize that Houston connection. That's really fascinating. So did you grow up knowing about Juneteenth or did it come to your awareness later?
Yeah, I grew up in the hood of St. Louis and I grew up on the west side. And I mean, I remember when I was in seminary, I did my MDiv at Gordon Conwell Seminary, and I was so blessed to take a class on African-American homiletics with Martin Luther King's pastor, Pastor Michael Haynes, who taught a class on Black preaching. And it was so awesome to sit in this class and hear about Martin Luther King's pastor talking about his buddy Mike like he knew him. And I was like, this is crazy. But I remember in class one day, he mentioned the Black National Anthem, and he was asking everybody, you guys know there's a Black National Anthem, right? And then like, I raised my hand. I was like, yeah, I know. But deep down, I was like, I didn't know we had a national anthem. And so it's like, you know, and they were like, yeah, well, you know the words. And you know, I was like, yeah, lift every voice and sing. Like, I was like trying to pretend like I knew. But it's sad, man. Like, it is so sad how in the hood, we just don't know a lot of our own history, like Juneteenth, national anthem. I mean, just so much Black history in St. Louis, you know, and that's one of the cool things about being in a place like Houston is that there's a much more vibrant kind of Black community and just historically. But no, I mean, like I grew up in the urban grit of St. Louis. And so I didn't know about it until I was an adult, honestly.
Well, one of the things that's so interesting is that this time, which happens to be the time when there's just such a ferocious and passionate racial energy that's bursting forth on the streets of every major city and lots of towns all around the United States, and in fact, has spilled over in its own energy and reasons all around the world, in actual fact. And as you say, certain cities like St. Louis and other cities are declaring Juneteenth as a holiday, and so are corporations who are declaring that it's going to be a regular part of full pay holidays that they give to their employees. And I think there's just a lot of education that's going on in the white community, but it is still also, as you say, unfolding in the African-American community as well. One of the things that I wanted you to talk about is, how do you imagine this unfolding in Juneteenth this year in Houston, given the history that you've just described? What will you do, and what do you imagine others will be doing in Houston?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that there's going to be a lot of celebrations, especially in churches. You know, I've already been seeing Black churches do in their services, or even after service on Sunday, or during that week, having special services on June 19th, whatever day it falls on. And I mean, I think, like you said, with all the stuff going on, there's going to be even more of that. And I think there's even more, I mean, again, hearing about my hometown just now, finally, and as you said, different people just now, and that's probably related to all the stuff going on, that people are starting to realize that, oh, like the order said, that was read, slaves are free. And so that's another way of saying Black Lives Matter. And so there's a new renewed energy to embrace that. So I think there's going to be a lot of that stuff going on. I know at my church here in Houston, out in the Katy area, there's going to be different Black cultural celebrations at service on Sunday, but you know, electronically. But I think there's definitely going to be a lot of that, and hopefully some solidarity between that and a lot of the protesting that's going on.
Right, exactly. You know, one of the things that you were saying was how different the cultures of Houston and St. Louis are, not least really even among African-Americans in each city. In St. Louis, you have a very different, much more highly charged, politically oriented Black community. And in Houston, for reasons I'd love to have you express, it plays differently. Just give us your impressions of that as we think about Juneteenth.
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting. Like, you know, I mentioned that I've been learning about Houston, and I don't even think I really ever connected this until now. But one thing I've been learning as I've been just kind of going around Houston and trying to learn and just sit with pastors, especially Black pastors, new and, you know, been there a long time. And I've even been blessed, even in just my first short year at Fuller in Texas, to even sit with some of the very Black pastors in the Third Ward who were literally a part of the desegregation of Houston back in the 1960s, and able to sit with them face to face and hear them tell me the stories and all that they've been doing for decades now in the city of Houston. It's been really powerful. But yeah, one of the things that's different, because this is my first time living in the South. Like I grew up in St. Louis, which is like on the border. It's kind of Southern, but it's like technically the Midwest. And, you know, I lived in Chicago, and then I lived in the East Coast for a long time in grad school, like, you know, Boston, New York, DC. So I got kind of used to that East Coast grit. So it's been interesting up until now, kind of comparing even just Black cultures from like the Midwest versus the East Coast. And now being in the South in this massive metropolis, that's even like a whole different dynamic, because in the same way that this guy came and he just announced, hey, slavery's over, just in case y'all didn't get the memo, Black folks are free, that it's almost like, from what I'm gleaning as I'm listening to people, that desegregation also kind of happened in a similar way in Houston, to where there were all these backdoor meetings with oil executives and politicians, white politicians and Black politicians and Black clergy, where they just kind of got together back in the 60s. And at the the time when cities like Chicago and Detroit and New York were on fire and there was riots going on, that kind of stuff didn't really happen in Houston in that kind of way. But it was, again, it was almost this desire to, you know, avoid that same kind of uprising that was happening in other urban centers in the North, that these Black and white leaders got together in these meetings and just decided to basically say, we're going to desegregate and we're going to do it in an orderly, scheduled fashion. And it's going to be a coordinated effort across political and commercial, economic, educational systems across the city. And it was just agreed upon. It's been interesting that I've been learning about some of the perspectives in the Black community in Houston, about maybe some of the positives and negatives of that dynamic and the residual effects that it's kind of had on the Black kind of habitus in Houston in 2020. And it's interesting, a lot of Black leaders I've met who are not from Houston, but are from like the East Coast or from the North, they're like, sometimes they kind of feel like the Houston Black community has historically been a bit passive in terms of how they approach different issues. But at the same time, there's also, compared to the cities that I've lived in and grown up, especially in St. Louis, there's a lot of educational and ecclesial and commercial success in the Black community. Now, learning Houston and, you know, exploring places like the Third Ward, I've never been in a community that's like considered the hood and there's mansions everywhere and there's like superstars like Beyonce and all that kind of stuff who have roots there. And like, you know, where I'm from, St. Louis, it's like more like Detroit, or, you know, where the hood is the hood. And so there's something to be said about the approach towards that. But I mean, at the same time, there's been all kind of protests going on. But I mean, you're right, going back to what you said, that I do kind of sense a different culture overall. And I think it's kind of a mix of some Southern Black culture, but also some of the peculiarities of Houston in general. But also that connection I was drawing about Juneteenth and then also desegregation. Again, it was just like, well, this has been announced, that this has been done for you. And so people have felt like there hasn't been that grit or that desire to fight for freedom that some folks have said make it difficult to fight for freedom now.
Right.
But that is changing, though, with a lot of the protests.
Well, you know, it's interesting because the personality that I often pick up when I'm in Houston is a personality of decide and make stuff happen. That's sort of part of the culture. It's a problem-solving sort of culture. So the thought that it would take the form that you've just described feels like it's part of that. Let's just tackle the problem, figure out what it is, and try to figure out if we can do something really forward-moving about it. I'm sure that nobody living in Houston thinks that that work is complete, but it is interesting to really hear about how much progress has been made in the ways that you've just described. So thank you for that. You've referred several times to growing up in the hood in St. Louis. That's a long journey from that to being not only a church historian that teaches at a theological seminary like Fuller, but actually, you specialize really in ancient African Christianity and the emergence of what was happening in the very earliest days of African Christianity. I'm going to come to that in more detail, but that journey is quite a journey. So tell us about the hood and the steps that happened along the way that ultimately brought you to this.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. I mean, it really connects because, you know, I would say that both as a pastor and as a scholar, my sense of call from the Lord is one and the same, and it just works itself out vocationally in different ways, but it's really the same thing, is that my deepest and most specific burden and call is really just wanting to encourage Black people in particular that Jesus is their Lord and that they have a home, that the gospel is a liberating force for Black people, and that the church is a place of empowerment for Black people in particular. And of course, not exclusively, but that's really my biggest burden. And especially so that Black people can understand and know that God has made us Black on purpose, that Black is beautiful and that Black is in God's image, and that Jesus has made it so through the cross that we can follow him exactly the way he made us. And that's really my biggest burden. And I would say the reason for that burden is because I really didn't know that growing up. Again, St. Louis is like a whole different animal altogether. I remember when I went to Wheaton College when I was 19, and one of my best friends in college was one of the only other Black students at the school, and he was from the south side of Chicago. And so I would always go to his house and visit on breaks and on the weekends and stuff, and I would just get blown away. Like I was talking about what it's like in Houston, the south side of Chicago was my first experience in a Black community where there were like Black educated doctors, lawyers, Black professionals, even in the midst of the hood, that there was an economic mix of people. That blew my mind. Honestly, when I would go to the south side of Chicago with my friend, I felt like, probably going back to Juneteenth, like a slave probably felt when that order was read, kind of like, really? We're free? Like, I didn't know we could do that. Like, that's honestly, my first thought when I would be in South Chicago and I'd see Black men walking down the street in suits holding briefcases, I was like, I didn't know that that was possible. I had no idea. Because in St. Louis, you don't see that. You in the hood in St. Louis, you do not see that. And on the flip, St. Louis is so racially segregated. There's a street that cuts through the city and it cuts it in half. consistently, everything north of that street is black and everything south of it is white, but not only racially, but economically. Everything north of that city is hood. It's dilapidated homes, empty lots, predatory loan places, check cashing places, chicken wing joints. And then everything to the south is like yoga studios and pet grooming stores and condos and this and that. And so it's this contrast. I became saved at a young age. I grew up in a small, kind of predominantly white, Jesus people, 70s kind of hippie, like evangelistic church that with godly people. They love the Lord, and they would come across that line. So my church I grew up in was about a mile from my house, but it was planets apart. You know what I'm saying? And so these people would come into our neighborhood to reach the inner city, to come in and reach the hood, and come in and bring Jesus into the place that, you know, apparently Jesus wasn't there, I guess. And they would come in, and my mom was single mom at the time. They were coming in, loving on my mom, you know, helping us pay the bills, bringing food, all that kind of stuff. And we just grew up going to that church. You know, my church was right next to Washington University, you know, the big university in St. Louis. And it was like, again, just a mile down the street. And I would traverse this line and just see the world. And so I, you know, became saved at an early age. And I put my faith in Jesus as my Lord and Savior. I was like 7 years old. You know, I asked my pastor to baptize me when I was 10. I was like evangelizing, you know, kids in elementary school. I was sharing the gospel. Like, I just had this burden for the gospel, because not having my dad around at that time, the idea of a heavenly father that pursued me and died for my sins and rose again, that appealed to me. And I just gave my life over to Jesus, and I felt a call to ministry. And I was slanging tracts in school, and I was telling people about Jesus in the cafeteria, on the block, everywhere. But my perception of Christianity was that it's white. It's a white, middle-class, suburban, evangelical thing, because that was the church I grew up in. And, you know, my church, that's my whole world. You know, that was my whole little, you know, that was my concept of Christianity as a whole, was my little church. And they love the Lord. Great people, but nobody ever sat down and told me, if you really want to be a good Christian, you got to act, look, and feel like a white, suburban, educated person. Nobody ever told me that. And yet, in a million ways, they told me that indirectly all the time, every day. And so I just internalized that. And so when I was about 16, I felt the Lord call me to ministry. And I had this automatic desire to study and to like learn more. Cause I was like, you know, if I'm going to be a pastor and be a leader in God's church, I need to understand the word better. Cause I'd be reading my Bible and I'd read the footnotes and I had all these questions and nobody in my little, you know, church could really explain it to me. And, you know, I'd be reading footnotes that said like Septuagint and Vulgate. And I'd be like, what is this stuff? I don't know what this means, you know? And so I need to go study. And so the Lord opened up the door. You know, went to Wheaton as an undergrad and barely got in by the skin of my teeth. It was the only school I applied to. Nobody in my high school went to college, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, just the Lord opened up that opportunity and I loved it and I soaked it up. But at the same time, I was really attentive to the economic and racial disparities, you know, in this. It felt like I had opened up to this whole world of theological education. I was like, I had no idea there were these kind of places where you can just study the Bible all day. Like, I used to be in high school bored as a mug because I'd just be sitting in here, algebra class, chemistry class. I'm like, I don't care. I don't care about none of this stuff. But it was weird. Like, I was a bad student, but not because I was like thugging and stuff, because like a lot of my homies were doing that. But I was like a bad student because I'd be reading the Bible in class because I didn't care about what the teacher was talking about. And so, you know, that's a bad, you know, I don't tell my students to do that. But I was like, I just want to study the Bible. I just want to study theology. I don't care about all this other stuff. And so I finally was able to be in that place where I was like taking classes in theology, church history, and ministry. But again, I was still seeing the lack of me being represented in this whole thing. And I remember taking a church history class from John Chrysostom to Aquinas to John Calvin to Jonathan Edwards. It was just, you know, the great white men of church history. And I was like, where am I at? Where are we at? Like, what is going on? And then it'd be like one day at the end of the semester for black theology or global theology. Like, it's in the modern times that things become global. And so I was just like, I was really attentive to that. And then when I was in seminary, I kept going. I didn't even know what seminary was. I thought what I was doing was seminary. I was going to be just get my degree and be done and go back and just be a ministry. But, you know, I heard about Gordon Conwell having this urban campus. So I went there. And my first semester, you know, I was taking classes and it was, you know, in the inner city and it was a bunch of diverse students. And it was just like heaven for me. I was like, man, this, and it was all like second career, like people in ministry, all ethnicities, Hispanic, Black, Southeast Asian, you know, white, everybody. And everybody was in ministry and it was all focused on the hood. And that's when the Lord told me, he was like, this is what he was calling me to do. So I wasn't going to do the PhD, but I was like, all right, I'm going to go ahead and get a PhD and go all the way with this thing. And so that I can do stuff like this, that I can provide theological education for marginalized communities that can't get it. Cause there's so many people who love the Lord like I did, but just can't get to seminary. They can't get financially, culturally, all these different ways. It's just inaccessible. And I was like, I want to help to try to bridge the resources of the Theological Academy to the hood and the church, the hood church, where the gospel is blowing up everywhere. And then specifically, I took a class on the early African church. And again, I was like, yo, ain't nobody ever tell me none of this stuff. Again, and I took classes, but nobody told me the church was in Nubia and Ethiopia and all this stuff. And especially because I was peeping how we always talk about globality in the modern context, like the church was Western and then one day it became global. And there's even books that say like Christianity becoming global. And I'm like, no, Christianity's always been global. And so that was specifically how I got really hip to that and was like, man, like if more people knew that, you know, especially because one of my burdens evangelistically is like communities, especially in the Black community, that are like Christianity is the white man's religion. And, you know, that's all it is. So we don't want nothing to do with that because it's not for Black folks. Christianity came to Black folks in slavery. And that's really what got me hip to that, was saying, all right, I want to understand more about how Christianity has always been among Black people. It didn't just come to us in slave ships, but it's always been among Black people. And I want to really understand that and just share that. You know, sorry for the long answer, but.
Well, I know I'm glad you went into all that detail. That's extremely important for us to hear. So thank you for that. You know, one of the things I most admire about you is that you are a multi-intersectional person, because you're a deeply committed scholar, you're committed deeply as a pastor, you're committed also as an evangelist, and you're committed to this whole moment that we're in right now in activism, but also the long journey of social change. So to hold on to all four of those things is quite amazing. And one of the things that captures that for me is the story about your name. So can you tell people about your name? Vince Bantu.
Oh, for sure. Again, it all connects, because going back as a young person, I was, you know, always, and especially, you know, being biracial, my dad is African-American, my mom is white. So they're from the different sides of St. Louis. And so I always was traversing that line, thinking about identity and thinking about who am I, and especially who am I in Christ? Because my thing, that I was saved at an early age. And I was, again, one of those thousand ways that I was told to be white was the many times I heard race doesn't matter, color doesn't matter. You know, I don't see color, God doesn't see color, so don't think about that stuff. It was like, I think I might have grown up in the most starkly racially segregated city in the world, at least in the United States. Like, St. Louis is on a whole other level with how consistently and thoroughly it is. You can't grow up in a place like that and be biracial and tell someone, don't think about race. No, that's like traumatizing. And on top of that, Jesus doesn't want you to think about race. If you want to be a good Christian, you'll stop thinking about that stuff. And so I believe that. I imbibe that. I told myself, stop thinking about it. Don't worry about it. Just be a Christian. And yet I'm getting stopped by the police. I'm being 2 seconds away from being a Mike Brown, my own self, having police search me and put the gun in my face, all that kind of stuff. But I'm like, okay, I got to just not think about this. And I'm just a Christian. And so, you know, that's how I'm being discipled. And that was rough, you know? And so I remember I went to Urbana, the InterVarsity Missions Conference. I was 19. And I never heard that many Christians talk about racial reconciliation and justice and all that kind of stuff. And I was mad. My first reaction was I was mad, because I was like, why are these people talking about race so much? Why are they talking about, they shouldn't be talking about that. This is supposed to be about missions. They should just be focusing on their identity as Christians and forget all this race stuff. But it was really like I was jealous, because I was like, I've always had these questions and I've always wondered about this stuff. And I just had no concept of being able to do that in Christ and as a believer. And so one of the things that always bothered me was the fact my birth name was Campbell. So my name was Vince Lee Campbell. My middle name is after my father, Leroy. And then Campbell was, I remember the first time I watched Roots growing up, you know, I think any Black person in my generation, you know, there was that moment where your parents sat you down and made you watch Roots. You know, that was the way to learn about American history and slavery and all that. So I remember that scene where Kunta was getting whipped and, you know, they were telling him, your name is Toby. And he was like, my name is Kunta Kinte. And then he finally couldn't do it anymore. And he called himself Toby. And by taking on that name, I remember even as a kid watching, I was like probably 10 years old the first time I watched that. And I remember thinking like, so it almost feels like as Black people, as descendants of slaves, to still be walking around with these slave masters' names, it feels like we've been branded and we're still carrying this brand. And I was like, I don't like that. But again, I was just being told, like, don't do that. But then when I finally, you know, really came out of that colorblind theology and came into a colorful theology, which is much more biblical, then I was like, okay, I want to change my name. You know, again, that's, I think, at the heart of so many Black people, even people who are rejecting the gospel, it's this search for identity and the search for meaning, especially about where Black people, you know, fit. And so you got folks changing their names to Arabic names or, you know, Hebrew names or all these other stuff. But I was like, I want something African. But I was like, I don't know where my ancestors came from in Africa. I didn't even know who my grandfather was. So I couldn't trace my ancestors backwards from starting with me. And so I did those DNA tests and I did like a few of them. And then I got the idea. This is when that Henry Louis Gates documentary came out years back, African-American Lives. And that's kind of what gave me the idea. So I did a few few of them, but they were really spread out, the results. They try to tell you this is where your ancestors come from, but they were real spread out across the African continent, you know, the patrilineal test that I did, all three of them. And they were saying that's probably because of the Bantu migration, you know, and that's why most sub-Saharan African people groups are considered Bantu peoples and Bantu languages, whether it's in the Congo or Kenya or South Africa or even parts of Nigeria, that most languages in Africa are connected linguistically. And there's even like a family of languages called Bantu languages and Bantu peoples, and because of the Bantu migration. So when I kept hearing that word come up, I was like, oh, I kind of like that, because I can't know exactly where my ancestors are from. And in all likelihood, they're probably from all these places because of all the different places folks were stolen from and then shipped to through the Caribbean and South America and across the US, and then cultures were blended together and mixed. So in a sense, you know, Black people on this side of the Atlantic are really children of the continent. And so I was thinking I wanted something that embraced kind of a pan-African concept. And so the word Bantu means people, and specifically, like, for example, in South Africa, it actually took on the connotation of Black people. Like, even in apartheid, just like over here, we had white and colored fountains. They had white, colored, which meant someone like me, mixed, and then they had Bantu water fountains. It was like another way of saying Black, and it has this connotation of Blackness. And even Desmond Tutu's idea of Ubuntu, they're kind of related words. And so I kind of just kept hearing it and thought, like, oh, that'd be a cool name to have something, again, African, that it goes back to our roots, that wherever my ancestors were from, they were Bantu people.
Wow. How was it to change your name in that way? What happened for you as you went through that process? Because it's a huge process that you've just described internally, but then suddenly one day your name becomes something different. How did that unfold for you and for the people that were around you, your family and friends?
Oh man, that's a great question. It makes me think about Song of Songs 1:5, where Solomon's bride says, "I am Black and beautiful. Do not despise me, daughters of Jerusalem." So, like, to me, what that shows is that even in the Old Testament, there was colorism and there was anti-Blackness. But also the word of God says that Black is beautiful, and that even in the midst of anti-Blackness and white supremacy and colorism, that the word of God actually says Black is beautiful. And so for me, you know, as the Lord has been bringing me out of internalized racism and all these other kind of things, there's all these different ways to, like, say, I am Black and beautiful. Changing my name was like yet another way of saying I am Black and beautiful. And learning ancient African languages is another way of saying I am Black and beautiful. When you come into theological studies, whatever color you are, you get inundated with all of these foreign European terms that, just as part of the work of the academy, you just throw French and German and Latin phrases in your prose and it makes it sound more refined or whatever. So I'm like, okay, you know, I've been doing that now with ancient African words. For example, instead of using the word theology, I'm really starting to use this word hymenote, which is an ancient Ethiopian word that means theology or doctrine or belief. And so I just kind of use it in my theological parlance. Like, I'll just talk about like a hymenote of the church or whatever. And it's not to say that the other stuff is bad, but it's just as a way of reconnecting. And so with my name and with all these other things, and Black folks will find all ways, you know, whether it's people wearing dreads, even on the job, when they say that's not professional, wearing dreads is another way of saying I'm Black and beautiful and I'm wearing these dreads, or whether it's with African clothes or whether it's speech pattern, whatever. There's so many different ways that the beauty of Blackness can be asserted. And for me, changing my name and, you know, going back to something that was etymologically and linguistically more connected to my ancestry rather than a slave name that was, you know, imprinted upon, you know, my ancestors, it just feels like another way of saying, along with the bride, I'm Black and beautiful.
I'm Mark Laberton. You're listening to Conversing, a production of Fuller Studio. You know, one of the first books that you wrote is a book that is called A Multitude of All Peoples, Engaging Ancient Christianity's Global Identity. I want to pick up on a couple of things that you've said and then have you comment a bit about this, because one of the great gifts that God's given you is that you are a deeply inquiring mind and spirit, but you're also an exceptional linguist. And this has given you an ability to move into the languages that you have to master in order to do the work that you've been doing theologically in a Western tradition. But in addition to that, because you've had this strong sense of wanting to recover the early African church and ancient African Christianity, it's also meant learning lots of other languages. So when this first book came out, which is a book that may, well, at least I'm assuming that may have been related to the topic that you had for your dissertation, since it's your first book, that's not an uncommon thing. But I also was really struck by the fact that it's engaging ancient Christianity's global identity. That's a set of words that I think for listeners that have just been hearing you talk, it makes total sense. But they are not a likely set of words, as you know, right? Because that's part of what makes your scholarship so important, because you're trying to bring things together that have not been seen to belong together in this really profound way that your work is doing. So talk to us about that. And then eventually I want you to also then move to talk about how you understand what's going on these days in the United States, especially with all the protest movement, the police violence and so forth, around issues of identity, because that's clearly a major part of this. But first, take us back into the ancient world and then move us to today.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, man. Like, I appreciate it. When I first really kind of got hip to the fact that Christianity has a global identity, that it's no one person's religion. I mean, again, in the hood, as you mentioned earlier, like, I'm a scholar evangelist, or at least that's what I aspire to live up to. And I mean, I'm out here sharing the gospel. You know, that's my heart. It's like when I was a kid and I want to see people come to know Jesus. And I want to see especially our community's lives transform. And one of the biggest things you come across in the hood is that's the white man's religion. You know, and you could have cats that are in like all different kinds of religions that they don't even agree with each other. They actually, you know, get on each other's nerve. Hebrew Israelites, Kemetic, you know, Moorish science, God and earth, all these different movements. But what they have in common is that Christianity is the white man's religion, and we good on that. And 9 times out of 10, they probably grew up in the church. And so what that lets us know is it's not even like starting with people who like maybe for centuries come from a non-Christian tradition. These are folks that like, they know, they've been there, done that. And they're like, I'm good on the church. Yeah, I'm good on praying to a blonde hair, blue eyed Jesus. And I'm like, I can kind of understand that to a degree, but they're throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And they say, again, it's a white man's religion, right? I just got off another podcast, you know, African-American urban podcast, talking about trying to address these people that say things like Christianity was invented by the Roman Emperor Constantine in the 4th century at the Council of Nicaea. And then it was a mechanism of conquering in this sign of the cross. And then later on, it went throughout the Roman Empire and then the Crusades and then, you know, the transatlantic slave trade. Da, da. So, I mean, you can even see how truth is mixed in there. And then it kind of gets stretched in a certain kind of narrative and way that Christianity is constructed as this inherently oppressive religion, and that any black person that follows Jesus is brainwashed, is still enslaved in their mind. And so these are the folks that the Lord's really given me a burden for. And that's really what drives the scholarship, is by showing that, well, actually, there's been black Christians since day one. And that even before all of these kind of Western imperial colonizing oppressive versions of Christianity, which I would say is really no Christianity at all, it's not the Christianity of Jesus. But before this perverted colonizing expression of Christendom, I could say, started off, there was already Christians of every tribe, nation, and tongue, and multitude of peoples that was going in every direction. And that included black folks. And then in fact, you know, Christianity has been among black folks, and it did not enter the African continent by force, but it actually came freely. And actually, some of the oldest African nations were Christian nations, like, you know, like Ethiopia, and also the only black country in the world never to be colonized, and has been a Christian nation. And so that's really my heart, is just to kind of what got me into that whole thing, and to show, again, as you mentioned, that Christianity has a global identity. It's a global faith that maybe unlike all other faiths, it's not connected to one tribe. It's not connected to one nation or language or people group or land, but it's for all peoples. And it's that inherently. And that's really the evangelistic and the community kind of impulse behind, you know, what kind of makes me. So as you mentioned, it's kind of the interdisciplinary thing. It's doing history, but kind of with like a missiological, apologetic, and evangelistic bent to it.
Right. So what would be an example of a contribution of African Christianity in the earliest days that has particularly got your attention in some way? Like, wow, that is not something that I grew up or that I see or hear in other voices.
Oh my goodness. I'm so glad you asked that. I got it right here. Right now I'm working on a follow-up text. And again, I just feel so blessed that this synthetic kind of work of ministry and scholarship that is being able to be connected to the church. Cause like straight up, the Lord gave me the idea for this next project I'm working on right now with University of California Press from black urban pastors who are more and more, I'm sharing with them like, man, we got to know about this. And they're eating it up. They're like, word, there was theologians who wrote in the Egyptian language and Ethiopian language, blah, blah, blah. Like, man, break it down, Vince. Okay. And then I'll be telling them, yeah, y'all got to get that stuff. Yeah. I mean, read the Western stuff too, but like, don't just read Chrysostom and Aquinas and Calvin and Luther. I mean, read those cats, but also like read some of the, like, we know those names. We don't even know the names Zara Yacob or Georgius of Sogla or Narsai or Jacob of Sarug or Walata Petros. There's all these African African and Middle Eastern names and theologians that wrote copious amounts of theology that we don't even know. Even scholars don't even know. And like, and again, that's white supremacy right there. Even what's a household name and versus what isn't, or what gets seen as specialized and niche versus what's commonplace or garden variety. There's like, you know, kind of mainstream theology, and then there's the extra stuff, right? I mean, we see how white supremacy just gets into all of that. So we got to decolonize, right? And so that's what I'm trying to do, because they hit me back with like, Vince, okay, that's cool. I want to get to these authors. I want to get to these scholars you're talking about, these other theologians, and we got to read them too, because they wrote contemporary to these Western theologians and they wrote just as much. So, okay, I'm going to get them. And then they'll be like, dag, hey, Vince, you know what? I tried to get it, but man, that was with such and such university press and that mug cost like $180. I don't know if I could do all that. Or it's in some obscure academic publication that can't nobody get. Again, whereas you can get on your fingertips on your phone right now, the writings of Western theologians. You don't even have to get academic publication or edition of it. You can just read on your phone. And with this stuff, it's so hidden and so hard to get. And some of it hadn't been translated into English yet. Maybe it was translated into German or French or Italian, or it hadn't been translated at all. And so I'm like, man, this white supremacy stuff, it's all over all of this. So, man, we're doing this project right now. We got like a dozen translators, different scholars all over the world, and we're going to translate primary text into English. And it's going to be a reader. It's going to be like a bunch of texts, Chinese, Arabic, Ethiopic, Nubian, Armenian, Persian, all this different stuff, all Christian theology, all pre-15th century, pre-colonialism, and just try to put it in the hand. But that idea came from Black pastors who were telling me, Vince, we want to get hip on this stuff, but this stuff, it costs the guap. Like, you know, it costs a pretty penny. We can't get to this stuff. I'm like, all right, I'm going to get on my grind and I'm going to get this for you. So one of those texts in that reader I was just literally working on right now is this mug right here. This is, now again, this is a very inaccessible academic publication. That's a great publication, but it's not accessible to the common person. So what I'm doing is I'm translating this text, and it's going to be one of the several ones in this. Going back to the question, I did not know that there was actually a Reformation movement in Africa even a century before the European Reformation started by Martin Luther in the early 1500s, that in the 1400s, a century before him, by this time, Ethiopia has been a Christian nation for over a millennium, for 1,000 years. And there was actually a group of Christians started called the Stephanites. They followed a person named Estephanos, and he started a monastic movement. And he was making a lot of the same arguments that Luther made a century later in Europe, talking about things like his main arguments, we shouldn't be praying to Mary, or we shouldn't be praying to any other than Jesus. We shouldn't be putting any church teaching or any other thing on the same level as scripture. We shouldn't be bowing and prostrating before the Ethiopian king. All of this very similar arguments that Luther made to the Catholic Church, Estephanos made to the Orthodox Church in Ethiopia, and he was vastly persecuted. And this text tells the story of his life and how he ultimately was killed for his faith. And this movement was vastly persecuted, but there was a whole movement of monks in Ethiopia. It was basically like the African Reformation, and it happened a century before. And they're even still revered by many Ethiopian Protestants even to this day as saints, even though they're still seen as heretics, but you know, by a lot of other folks. But again, I had no idea. I was like, I ain't never heard of no Estephanos before. I didn't know that happened, you know. And so I was like, yeah, I mean, we need to read Luther and Calvin and all that, but we need to be reading this brother right here. And so that's going to be in the reader, but that's just been blowing my mind.
It's fantastic. I can't wait to read that. When do you think that project will be available?
Right now, we're doing the first drafts of translations, and we're looking at fall of 22, hopefully when it'll hit the shelves.
Great. Wow. That's fantastic. Well, stay tuned for more updates on that work, because that's an extremely important thing. So draw the line between those sets of discoveries and all those texts and the significance of those voices and the discovery of an African Christian identity to today and the issues of identity that are connected and disconnected from the gospel in the streets as policing and every other conceivable form of racism is admitted to be intertwined with white history in America, white Protestant, white evangelical history in America. What would the connections be, and how might those early texts and the theology you're discovering there connect with the crisis of today?
Oh man, that's powerful right there. I mean, I would say there's so much going back to the like ancient African context, right? Let's look at somebody like Shenouda of Atrip, who was an Egyptian monk who is the greatest writer in the history of the Egyptian language, one of the oldest languages in humanity. And he wrote in the Egyptian language dozens of texts, and he was a Christian monk leader. leader in late 4th and early 5th century Egypt. And he led a monastery when Christianity, because of Constantine and all these kind of ways it was becoming popularized, a lot of monastic movement was like, no, we ain't trying to go that way. We're trying to be a communitas, right? A koinonia, a beloved community of faith. And not only did he teach people, he brought in people into the monastery in southern Egypt, people who were like living in poverty. They would come in and they would get saved. They would start walking with Jesus. They would live in community and they would become empowered too. He would give them jobs. They would become farmers or people who were illiterate become literate, and they would also become like walk with Jesus. They would do prayers and spiritual disciplines, live in community with each other. And this brother was also critiquing a lot of his contemporaries who followed the Egyptian traditional religion, which was mainly for the wealthy people, because I mean, it costs money to mummify people and to pour out libations and build temples and all that stuff. It don't cost nothing to follow Jesus. And so Christianity was actually more popular in Egypt with the poor folks, whereas the traditional religion was mostly with the wealthy folks. And he was critiquing a lot of those people who were oppressing the poor, talking about similar things as today. You're underpaying and overworking people. I mean, he would publicly, in the context of church, in the pulpit, he would use the pulpit in his monastery to critique the economic and oppressive systems of injustice that was going on in his day. And so what you saw in that was a well-rounded 360-degree expression of what it means to be the church. It wasn't like this, like we have a lot, not a lot of today, where we have like a bifurcation between, well, is it justice or truth? Is it, you know, biblical infallibility or social justice and human flourishing? Or, you know, is it progressive, you know, liberal or conservative and the truth, fundamentalist, modernist, all these different ways that we have to like kind of bifurcate and make this binary into the gospel. The Egyptians, they understood all of what the gospel is revealed to be in the life in Jesus and the early church, and they were doing it. And they did it on the power of the gospel, that they were bringing people into the truth of the gospel, teaching them the word, and they were boldly denouncing people who were oppressing the poor in his context. And so that was all seen as one and the same. It would have been ridiculous to say that, like, using the Bible to fight economic and racial injustice is like a liberal agenda or it's a political agenda. No, this is a biblical agenda. And so that was just taken for granted. And so that's the legacy of ancient African Christianity. And even in this country, there's still a lot of that that's at the core of even the history of the Black church in this country, that even despite, I mean, it is a miracle of the Holy Spirit that Black people in this country are Christians. It's a miracle. I mean, you know, all these communities I'm engaging with, it makes all the sense in the world why an African-American in this country would want nothing to do with Christianity and say, I want nothing to do with this religion. This literally brought us over in slave ships. And we don't know about all that awesome stuff that was happening in Egypt and Ethiopia. All we know is these Dutch and English and Portuguese slave ships came over here talking about Jesus and kidnapped my family member and said that Jesus gave them a right to do it. And then going through Jim Crow slavery, all that kind of, it makes all the sense in the world. And yet through the providence of the Holy Spirit, he spoke the truth of the gospel through agents of the enemy. That blows my mind. That the truth of the gospel shined through people who were being in the employ of the evil one. That's a miracle unto itself. And yet, again, the true gospel shone through. And I think about people like Phyllis Wheatley, who also was an evangelist and preached the gospel and also denounced slavery publicly, or people like Olaudo Equiano or Atobo Kuguano over in England that started the Sons of Africa that also preached the gospel, were evangelists and understood the Bible to be, they interpreted slavery through the lens of the story of Joseph, saying what my brothers intended for evil, God has turned around for good and brought me the gospel so that they could fight for freedom for other Black people all over the world, and actually gave exegetical arguments as to why the common understanding that Black people were sons of Ham and were destined to be slaves and slavery was okay, that even in the early 1800s were making exegetical and theological arguments as to why slavery was wicked and unbiblical as it was being practiced in England. And so there's always been, whether it's ancient or early modern, there's always been this expression of Christianity that is woke, so to speak, that is robust and fully and wholly biblical, that I really think that we really need to retain now. Because going back to, you know, like what you'd asked about what's going on today, I think one of the things that I lament or I'd love to see more of is, I think one of the differences even between the Black Lives Matter movement of today and even 50 years ago, the movement that King and Ella Baker and others were starting was very much based in the Black church and in the Black community. And again, it was theological and it was like gospel spirituals. I mean, the gospel was laced all in and throughout the entire movement. Whereas today, it's not really as much the case. But let's just be real up in here. In large part, a lot of the Black Lives Matter movement is happening almost apart apart from the Black church. So there's this movement for freedom going on, but it's not really coming out of the church as much. And so I think that's one of the reasons I think why it's helpful to go back to this history and understand that we have a long and rich history that starts from the New Testament, goes through the African continent, and even goes right up until just a few decades ago. We have a long trajectory in history of a Christian witness that sees no division between evangelism and activism, right? I mean, you mentioned that earlier, but the last thing I'll say is that just as me as a, you know, seminary professor, pastor, whatever, just as a Christian, I don't know that many people who would be down to go with me if I said, hey, man, you want to go evangelize? You want to go share the gospel with people and, you know, try to see if we can lead some people to the Lord? Let's go out to the mall or wherever and let's just share the gospel. And then if I were to also say, hey, do you want to go out and let's go protest and let's go shout Black Lives Matter and let's protest police injustice or let's protest families being separated at the border or land treaty violations or all these other kind of things, indigenous people, let's go protest these injustices, right? Most people who I would ask to go do one of them with me, they would be down, but not be down with the other one. I don't know that many people right. who would be down to roll with me on both of those things. And I'm like, we have a long history of people in the church who understand the call of the church to be all of that. It's not one or the other. It's all of that. I just really want to see us get back to that point where we go out. And I mean, even this last few weeks, I've been out protesting. I've been out shouting and all that kind of stuff. Some of the chants, I have to change them up and kind of Christianize them a little bit, you know, and put some gospel up in there. I ain't saying some of that stuff they're saying, but I'm going to say Black Lives Matter all day. And I'm going to say no justice, no peace all day, because that's biblical stuff right there. But I'm also going to hold up signs that have Bible verses, and I'm going to try to do it in the power of the gospel and on the authority of the Word of God, which again, we have a long trajectory of doing.
Dr. Bantu, I can't thank you enough. This has just been amazing, as I knew it was going to be. So I feel like you've given us a global history. You've given us an African history. You've given us a Christian history. You've given us all the reasons why the four things that I said describe you, scholar, pastor, evangelist, and activist, all come together, not because you're taking four things and gluing them together, but because they, as you just said, inherently belong together, as opposed to being seen as four separate things that are, as you said, often even in tension with each other, where it feels like it's a choice. And what you hold together in your very being, and you've so wonderfully expressed, is that all of this is God's love for the world. And we have to let that be manifest first in our own life and our understanding, and then it's got to be manifest in the community and in the context of God's people. And, you know, I just want to say, it feels to me like just a phenomenal gift that God has brought you to Fuller. We need your voice inside Fuller, because Fuller needs to learn all of these things even more deeply than we have yet done. And we want to be an agent of that in the world. And to think that you're here to join Dwight Radcliffe and people like Alexis Abernathy and many other people on our faculty who are deeply engaged in these same kinds of concerns is just a phenomenal gift. So God bless you. Thank you for what you've just shared. And I do look forward to having a follow-up conversation when that book comes out and it's accessible so that people can actually read it. I want to have another conversation where we have a chance to talk about all the insights that we need to learn from the early African church. Thanks again. God bless you. Thanks very much.
Oh, thank you.
You've been listening to a production of Fuller Studio. Fuller Studio provides articles, podcasts, videos, and other resources for a deeply formed spiritual life. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app or visit us at fuller.edu/studio.